Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon to another exciting episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with the coolest of all co-hosts in all of BTR land. I tell you, in all of BTR land, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Cool Mike.
Good afternoon, Annie. Thank you. What a great introduction. Welcome, everybody, on this Tuesday, August the 11th, or August the 11th, August the 21st.
Hey, listen, it's only 77 days to Election Day. Time to fire Obama. How does that sound?
Oh, sounds too good to be true, actually. So, and we got a great show. And with that being said and done, I'll make a quick announcement. Then Annie goes to the PSAs. And that is, if you have Facebook and if you have Twitter, guess what? You can get closer and closer to Southern Sense, the number one show on Blog Talk Radio last week of all of the land. And that is Southern Sense at Twitter, Southern Sense, Facebook.com. We'll post the links in the chat room. Annie, take it from there.
All right. And then I'm going to give a PSA out to my most favorite organization that every single dollar that you donate, 99 cents on every dollar goes directly to the cause. This is the Independence Fund that hosts the Lieutenant Dan Weekend here in Beaufort, South Carolina. And I will let Gary Sinise, the actor from CSI New York, and Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, say it better than I can. So here is Gary Sinise to give you some information.
Hi, I'm Gary Sinise. Please join me this September 15th when, along with the Lieutenant Dan Band, I will return to Beaufort, South Carolina for the third annual Lieutenant Dan Weekend for an evening of fun, music, and show of support for our nation's military and their families. We'd also like to invite you or your company to join us in showing thanks to our nation's most severely wounded veterans by honoring a hero of your choice with a freedom flag. These freedom flags will be flown at the concert and are a perfect way to honor a special veteran in your life. 100% of the tax-deductible donation for a freedom flag will be used by all the Volunteer Independence Fund to support those most severely wounded veterans of the War on Terror. Myself and the rest of the Lieutenant Dan Band look forward to seeing you all once again this September, and I thank you for your support.
All right. The Lieutenant Dan week will start September 9th through the 15th. We will be broadcasting live with members of the Independence Fund and the Wounded Veterans out of Cat Island here in Beaufort, South Carolina. When they finish up their golf outing, we'll be at the Cat Island golf course, and we'll be broadcasting live from there. And by the way, once again, I have put my money where my mouth is. Back in April when they had the golf outing, I donated $100 to sponsor one of the holes on Cat Island for Lieutenant Dan, the Independence Fund golf outing. It was called the Healing Heroes. And once again, like I said, I put my money where my mouth is. I did get one of the flags. I donated for that. And I dedicated it to my father, a World War II veteran. So Dad doesn't know about this. Dad doesn't know about this, so I'm going to be sending it to him very quietly. He has no idea, but I did to my father.
Awesome. And as always here, we are a very, 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 very military-friendly show. That's awesome, Annie, and that was great. And I like the fact the last one we did, they couldn't do holes 1 through 18 because so many people were donating. So we were just somewhere along 1 through 18, which is great. And today we have a show dedication of another great fallen hero. She's absolutely beautiful. Please look in our show description. Annie will read about it. But, you know, as always, these people, 99 cents of every dollar, and these volunteers who are forming these groups to help these soldiers, I mean, they are giving their time. They're giving their gasoline. And I don't know if anyone's seen it, but gas is pretty expensive. But these are wonderful heroes helping our other heroes. You know, we're glad they came back, not in a body bag. But, you know, they need so much changes once they're back, not only psychologically but physically. They need rehabilitation. They've lost a limb or just anything. And this Lieutenant Dan weekend is just a great reflection of what this show is all about. And our wonderful leader, Annie, who is the number one show on Blog Talk Radio. I love saying that.
You keep on saying it. I haven't seen it yet, so I'll trust you.
Well, I told everyone else. We'll talk about that later. I made an enemy because I said that, but anyway, so be it.
All right. Those that follow the show know that we also start the show off with a dedication to a fallen military hero, and we will continue to do that because no one can ever say thank you enough for what these brave men and women have done for us and continue to do for us even today. So today's dedication goes out to Specialist Crystal M. Flats. She lost her life July 17th in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Specialist Crystal M. Flats, 28, of Houston, Texas, died from injuries suffered from indirect fire. She was assigned to the 1st Battalion, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade Comp Team, 82nd Airborne Division out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Her efforts and contributions as a member of the Fury Female Engagement Team have been exceptionally admirable, said Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Geihol, commander of the 782 Brigade Support Battalion. Crystal was unafraid, and her presence made the difference. I cannot capture in words my sorrow at her passing or my pride in her service to the nation. That was how he remembered Specialist Crystal Fitz, killed by indirect fire on July 17th. Specialist Fitz joined the Army in 2009 as a chemical operations specialist, and after training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and Fort Benning, Georgia, she was on her first deployment and was assigned to the 1st Battalion, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. She had volunteered for the Fury Female Engagement Team and had been trained in Pashto, so her unit could communicate with the Afghan people more easily. She was attached to the company 6 months before deploying and immediately impressed those around her with her motivation, tenacity, and drive to learn. C Company's Captain Sam Perlick said, "Her dedication to the unit and support to fellow paratroopers will be missed, and her contributions will be remembered." Fayetteville Observer noted, "Captain Sam Perlick said, Special Fits filled a critical role in the unit and took on an ever-increasing number of duties well beyond the scope of her experience and training. The day she died, she posted a photograph on her Facebook page. One of those photos that people send around that have captions. This one was a special member with a bandage on his forearm holding a helmet with a bullet hole in it. When she posted it, she said, let's be grateful for our many blessings today. So remember, so many have given of their lives that we have the privilege and the duty to make the most of ours. We will never forget their sacrifices. Let us do our best to live worthy of this freedom they fought and gave all for us to enjoy. Wrap our Gold Star families in your love and support. They pray every day, every heartbeat. Lord, we ask you to bring comfort and peace to their aching hearts." She signed it with a heart, saying, "Chaps." Of course, as everyone has many sides to their personality, Specialist Fitz was not just an outstanding soldier, but also a woman who dreamed of going home, dreamed of a spa day with her girlfriend and mom when she returned, a woman who loved hot tubs and beaches, and a woman whose boyfriend was a Southern gentleman. During her time in the Army, Specialist Fitz was awarded the Bronze Star Medal, the Purple Heart, the Army Commendation Medal, the Army Good Conduct Medal, the National Defense Service Medal, the Afghan Campaign Medal, and Bronze Service Star, the Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, the Army Service Ribbon, the Overseas Service Ribbon, the NATO Medal, and the Combat Action Badge and the Parachute Badge. Specialist Fitz was a daughter, a sister, and a girlfriend. She has many who mourn her passing. This was signed by Marine Corporal Joshua R. Asherby. There was a special page I found online, American Women Veterans. On this was posted, "I worked in the 4th Brigade. This woman was a very hard and dedicated soldier. She is flying high in heaven above. You can rest now, young soldier. Your work is done. May you rest in peace. Your sacrifice will never be forgotten. See you on the other side. Amen. Godspeed. Hoorah." It was signed by Bridget Spengler. Also was there, signed by Gary Obrin, "Few people are aware of the 18-hour days of hard work the 782 performs in their mission to facilitate the drawdown of our troops from Afghanistan via Kandahar Air Force Field. In the plywood office headquarters of their busy motor pool, their honor wall displays the pictures of the soldiers. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time with this. Displays the pictures of these soldiers lost since January when they began arriving at Kandahar. She's the first female to grace the current honor wall, which includes 15 soldiers prior to her death. She is an example of the courage and strength of the young Americans working in Afghanistan. In her case, as a member of the female support team, thank you, Specialist Fitz. You will not be forgotten. To all these men and women out there serving, we say thank you. For those that have lost their lives, we cannot even say thank you enough, or to their families send out enough prayers or love. So in that case, in their honor, we dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon, and you can find his song on YouTube and download it for free. This is My Name is America by Todd Allen Herndon, And please, remember these men and women who so bravely serve for our freedom. God bless them all.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name.
My strength was not taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is
America by Todd Allen Herndon, dedicated to all the brave men and women out there who have given and continue to give everything for our freedom. Oh, Mike, you know what I should do? I think I should buy stock in Kleenex.
Well, Annie, you know, it never gets easier. People, you know, it's almost a good that you're doing it, because this is just amazing. I think it just speaks for itself. As we begin the show, just always know that Annie and I are always so very, very grateful to those who have served, and especially those who have fallen. In a lot of ways, this dedication, we always see on TV how the girlfriend or the husband or the wife or whatever is running down the airport, you know, running down the hallway there, and the security's chasing her. Next thing you know, she's into the arms of the soldier, and they fall on the ground. Everybody's clapping, and they're kissing. You know what? For these people, they can't do that, sadly, but this is their hero's welcome here. So as we read it, I picture them walking down the airport runway, or not the runway, but into the airport, and everybody clapping and cheering for them. They are truly our heroes, and sadly, they didn't make it. But you know what? Freedom is not free, and we are grateful.
No, and you know what? I'm going to tell everyone out there listening, you know what you do? If you see someone in uniform, whether they're in an airport, a restaurant, the store, walk up and say thank you. You know, just the little things that you do can mean so much to them and make it feel as if they are doing something worthwhile. You know, my husband and I were out in our favorite watering hole the other day, and three Army Marines had come in. They were in their fatigues, and I guess they were waiting to find a place to sit for dinner. And while they're sitting at the bar having their cocktails or beers or whatever, I just quietly pulled the bartender over and I says, do me a favor. You see the three guys at the end of the bar, the ones in uniform? He goes, yeah. And I says, buy each of them a drink, but please do me a favor. Don't tell them where it came from. Just tell them it's from someone who wants to say thank you. It's as simple as that.
Yep.
You know, just make their day.
Yep, and I did that last night. We had a lady from the National Guard come into our nightclub, and we were doing the mud wrestling. So not only did she mud wrestle, but I introduced you to what I believe is her new honey, because her Facebook now is covered with pictures from them taken all of yesterday. So, anyway, I guess we got a little show today, and we got some two actually very, very good guests. I always like educated people who especially, not just political, but religiously. Hard to find those people in this world.
All right, we are going to introduce our guests. We have the Reverend Wayne Sedlick, and we have John Selk, both of Third Rail Radio. So if you do key in looking for Third Rail, make sure you put radio in on the search engine so that you can pull up their fantastic, fantastic website. And if you go to the website, you know what? Do like the rest of us are doing. Become one of the town criers so you can help spread the word along with them. So I want to welcome Reverend Sedlick and John Selk. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Glad to be here.
It is absolutely our pleasure. John, tell us about your website.
Well, we're very happy. We have a research team of over 20 people helping us and some outstanding young men who put together a website that's a work of love. It's found at the Third Rail Radio, all run together, the thirdrailradio.com. You just spotlighted, I think, the key reason that Wayne Sedlak and I are doing all of this. Years ago, we learned the difference when we did much broadcasting in the 1990s. There's a big difference tactically between fishing, in other words, trying to find key people to help in the cause, that's fishing, or just dumping the minnow bucket in the lake. We feel better at the end of every interview, Anne, of course we do, but that doesn't mean we accomplish anything unless we connect with great people like your listeners. So we have a program called the Town Crier Program. These are people that sign up to be local Paul Revere's, and we get out alerts to them. When the really big issues come up in Washington, we'll notify them before they become law. That's preventive medicine in politics. And Wayne and I did this with two big issues when we ran the Parent Information Network back in the 1990s. We worked with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and Doug Phillips's ministry when H.R. 6 came up in the Congress that would have virtually shut down home education. And we did it again when Hillary Clinton came up with her poisonous package, the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child. In both cases, these joint efforts of patriots like our listeners virtually shut down the switchboards in Washington with protest. That's the goal of our broadcast. So we hope that our listeners, yes, will look at our long book lists and that they'll see the profiles of our nearly 15 broadcast celebrities. That's all important. But becoming a town crier and being in a position to get the word before it becomes law and before others learn of it, that's our purpose, Anne.
Well, that is an excellent, excellent purpose. Now, Reverend, how did you become involved with this?
Well, John and I go back about, some 30 years. We have been involved. As John indicated, we were co-founders of the Parent Information Network, and we did oppose via a church back in the 1990s, which I pastored, and volunteers from that church in the Parent Information Network, we saw that the pulpits, the churches, are simply not addressing many of the issues out there. And many of the people then helped us, just like a research team, in an independent work from that Parent Information Network. And as a result, we were able to stop, kind of lead the charge in H.R. 6 and then the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child, which incidentally is coming up again. The latter, a different form of the U.N. Convention, which would very much bridle parental rights in all areas. That's a whole subject in itself, perhaps for a future broadcast of you, Annie. But the fact of the matter is, the political left learned took a beating on that and a few other, incidentally, on a few other treaties, UN treaties that were almost a shoo-in for passage. When, quite frankly, I believe God blessed us in using the Parent Information Network and our research team to go out and oppose them, and there was a thunderous response. Fact is, economics played a big issue or subject today. You know, we talk in terms of politics, but it's high time that the pulpit and the Christian church at large understand a sound set of sound set of principles for economics, especially in this beleaguered economy that's getting worse by the moment due to the schemes of Washington and government in general. So that's how I got involved. I've been in it actually since I was almost weaned on a lot of this by parents who were dedicated back in the 60s to take their stand. And John and I have done this many times on the air, including debate structures, debating individuals, as well as just simply teaching people, as John said, why the need, hence our broadcast today, and then how to make it work. The town crier system is a great opportunity for people with no obligation whatsoever. You get emails that'll update you, and then you act within your network. We can speak to that perhaps later on as we go on.
One of the things, Ann, that I think is most significant about my broadcast partner today, Wayne, I knew his father, a great man in Pittsburgh. Oh, that was a joy to know. Wayne knew by the time he was probably 12 years old that he wanted to become a pastor. His father was less than thrilled about this idea. He said, "Son, there are too many socialist pastors already. We don't need one of them named Sedlak." It was a conversation, something like that, with a very young and fervent fellow. But he said, "Your mother and I will help you to go to seminary if you first go to Grove City College." And Ann and Mike, you know about Grove City. It was the Hillsdale of the East, standing for individual liberty. He said, "If you'll go there and study under Dr. Hans Senholz, one of the world's great free market economists, your mother and I will be on board to help you in the future." And Wayne studied as a prized student of my friend Dr. Senholz. And I, about 10 years ago, I helped to co-sponsor an event where Dr. Senholz's prized students appeared at a fundraising event in Michigan for all the top donors of the Foundation for Economic Education. And we brought Wayne back to give a keynote address. So there's a lot of background. We have a pastor here who understands economics from a free market point of view. He's a pretty rare creature, Ann.
Wish I'd have known that. I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan right now, so I wish I'd have known that. That's really awesome. You know, it's amazing you mentioned you know his father. And there he is now, partners with you.
Yeah,
that is great.
Isn't that amazing? It is great.
What I find amazing is if people actually follow, you know, good Christian values, good moral Christian values, you end up finding that they are in essence conservatives, but yet they vote and they preach liberal. What is this? Why is that discrepancy there?
Wayne, how would you answer that? That's your purview.
There's a couple of reasons. They're mistaught. In fact, the area of social justice and humanitarianism attracts, as John likes to say, the best and the worst. When social issues are brought up politically, who doesn't in America have a heart? There are very few people in America that don't have a heart for people, victims of the tsunami, victims of this, that, around the world. We've had a heritage, a Christian heritage, of helping people. Unfortunately, the political left has co-opted a Christian past in its phraseology and ethic. And in doing so, they've borrowed what historically was part of the church and its charitable outreaches. Now, that ethic has been transformed into governmental control. And as a result, the Christian church has withered in much of its effect, and it does a charitable effect, charitable work. But further than that, the seminaries have drifted. Those that teach, the schools that teach the pastors, have drifted away from what was once a core curriculum that taught precepts. And I'll be frank with everybody that's listening. The Bible addresses sound principles of economics. I'm talking about free market economics. Over in an average of about one out of every five verses. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to go 10 verses into the Bible and find two precepts. It means that about 20% of the Bible actually lays very strong foundations, even into an advanced understanding of economics. And that is simply, I'm here to tell you, it's not taught. So as a result, we get co-opted with great phrases, helping the poor, and of course we should be helping the poor. That's our past. But the left has learned to use our, you might say, to borrow from a Christian past, a Christian conservative past, co-opt it, and use it for control economics, socialism.
Well, this is what I find where the hypocrisy lies. You know, they try to co-opt our religion, yet at the same time, if you are religious, they sneer at you.
That's
and
right.
They put you down. So what do you do? Do you follow your Christian values as they lay them out? Or you turn around and turn your back on all faith? And I think they're doing that deliberately. They're co-opting everything. They're
right.
Corrupting everything so that the only God you're going to bow down to will be the God of government.
That's
in fact, you're running into something called envy, which we'll discuss, I think, in a few moments. The envy mentality dominates the political left, and they cater to it, but they use humanitarian language. John?
Well, yes. I was going to say that a friend of ours on our broadcast team did a book report on a classic book that our readers could access if they go to the website, thethirdrailradio.com, and go to books or resources. They'll find reference to a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion, written by a great scholar. His name was Marvin Olasky, O-L-A-S-K-Y. Now, some of our listeners may already know about Olasky. They'll know that he was a communist. When alienated in college and graduate school in the East, he went the conventional way. He followed a heart that was being poisoned by propaganda. But when he woke up, he became a total Christian believer. It was by reading the Bible for an academic project he discovered all the economic truths that Wayne was discussing. In The Tragedy of American Compassion, he shows that inning by inning, in other words, in one historical phase after another in American history, the government began intruding and preempting, or you used a good word, Ann, co-opting Christian language to ensnare the people into doing it through government. And that's a trap. It looks like the easy way, doesn't it? So he shows without a doubt that every step of the way, government took over the territory of the church and eventually discouraged fervent Christians from doing what government can't do. The book makes the point that we not only are interested in giving financial support for the truly needy, but to help them and mentor them, to teach them the way out. And that is one of the key tragedies. Plus, making people virtually worship government rather than following our God. And listeners, God hates that. He does not do well with competitors who move in to his domain of fathering and protecting his children. End of sermon on my part. But the Tragedy of American Compassion is an absolute jewel. Olasky is also the editor of World Magazine. He's the former provost of King's College in New York. He's a magnum intellectual.
Wow. Well, listen, we've got a call that's been holding online very patiently. Let me bring this person in and see if they have a question. Area code 910, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. You have a question or a statement?
No, actually, I was just sitting here listening. Thank you.
Okay. What you have to do is turn your speakers down in the background because you're getting a little feedback there. I'm going to put you back on.
It's the alarm that's going off right now.
Okay. Okay. It's always great to have listeners calling in. Hey, listen, I'm going to ask you a question. Right now, the Democrats are fighting with the Republicans over the budget, and progressives are saying raise taxes, and we're not going to cut the budget unless you let us raise taxes. Why is that bad?
Well, to me, as I hear their rhetoric, they're talking about the very rich or the rich or people with money, and they're very sloppy in lumping them all together, it seems. They view such people as enemies, and that is nothing more than the old Marxist class struggle concept of some inevitable conflict between the haves, the people who have already saved money, and those who clearly do need more of it, the have-nots. And it suggests that they're two different types with two different interests. Don't believe that for a moment. They both have a common interest. It's Marxist thinking that would separate them, and this president, I'm sorry to say, is an expert at causing class division and class struggle. He is a Marxist. Don't let anybody back you off from that point. He's a classical Marxist. If you go to the Ten Commandments of Communism, the Communist Manifesto of 1848 by Karl Marx, and you go right down the checklist of what Marx said was needed for the total government control of a country, you'll see Barack Obama as the head leader in almost every one of them. So that's important. But here's where I'm going with that. I want to be practical, and I don't want to be a name caller. That's offensive to most of us. And I really believe that many of our conservative friends are every bit as idealistic as any swollen heart liberal that I know and care about. Here is my point. I can't think of an area of investment, whether we talk about stocks, we talk about bonds, real estate, oil and gas exploration. You can go on and on. And I'm a retired investment advisor, Ann. I hate to say that because that was such difficult work, having moral responsibility in any way, shape, or form for other people's money. That'll keep you up at night. But my point is that if you talk about people who have enough money to invest in stocks, what do those companies do? Those companies create jobs. They do research and development to produce better products at lower prices for the benefit of workers, consumers. They build new plant and equipment. They engage in construction. In other words, people who buy stock are not enemies of the so-called working man. They're the people who make it possible for these dear folks to be employed. When we get into bonds, what's the bond market? A bond is a loan, isn't it? So if we talk about people who buy company bonds, corporate bonds, they're providing the working capital for jobs, research and development, plant and equipment. Sounds the same. If we buy municipal bonds that finance city government, state government, or city-state governments, that money is used to pay workers' salaries, or to build public works, those that are really legitimate, roads, let's say, they provide employment. Is this the enemy of the working man? Of course not. A capital invested is money saved. And if you go into the book of Proverbs in the Bible, you'll see one brilliant economic statement or encouragement after another for people to save money. Savings are not hoarding. But when you listen to the Marxist rhetoric, you hear all kinds of poisonous terms that make enemies out of people with money. What about real estate? We're providing housing for people who need to live somewhere. That's not the work of an enemy. That's the work of a friend. And I could go on in. I think our listeners all understand what we're saying here. But there's another area. What is an employer? What's an employer? Well, he is usually the only customer for a worker's labor. If we started to define employers as being customers, a lot of confusion would go away. There are some people who are unfortunate enough to need two employers in America today. They work two jobs. But the man who employs them is not the enemy. He is the means for people to provide for their families and improve their standards of living. Now, that could sound like cheerleading until you start reading, and we have lots of simple economics books mentioned on our website. I really encourage, as you have a very advanced audience, your listeners of Southern Sense, they know the stuff because you've been teaching them. So if they go to the website, some of them will develop eye strain because they won't be able to leave the website. Okay, Ann, the main thing is we don't have labor and capital as enemies. They're friends.
No, actually, you got into something I was going to ask you next, is whether or not Wall Street was evil. And what people fail to realize, they keep on saying those evil capitalists on Wall Street, they're raking in all these profits and everything else. Uh-uh, no. What they're doing is they're earning profits for their company. And where do those profits go? They go to the investors. Who are the investors? If you have a bank account and you're earning interest on your bank account, you are one of those investors. If you have a pension with your company, your pension has invested in those companies. You are one of the investors. If you have a mortgage, the reason why your interest rate is so low is because you are one of those investors in one of those companies on Wall Street. And this is what they fail to understand. Now, right now, Obamacare has limited the amount of income these insurance companies and other medical companies can earn. Therefore, they have hurt the investors, who are you, I, me, the listeners.
Oh, Ann, that is so true. One of the areas where Wayne Sedlak taught me something in our family Bible hour that was almost like a layman seminary years ago. I was a pretty advanced student of economics when I met Wayne, but when he started talking about something called the envy mentality, and he had some colorful things, those who would poison one economic class against another, these are enemies, not friends. Wayne, how about sharing with Ann a little bit about the envy mentality as you taught it to me 20-some years ago?
Sure. One of the least trumpeted, if I want to put it that way, but yet most least trumpeted as far as understanding in the churches, yet most common ethical, shall I say, perversities of society, any society, is the envy mentality. The Bible refers to a militant envy as cultural bone rot. Let me explain. I've been a missionary to Africa, and like many missionaries, we find a solemn truth. When you go into the tribal areas, you'll find that many will deliberately make their huts not look so good. Why? Because envy, people who want other people's wealth. And the envy mentality had to be, you might say, untaught in the tribal areas. And if people understood becoming victimized there. Envy is that function of the human heart in our sinful state, our fallen state, that cannot stand when someone else, you might say, has something better than we do. I like to say their glory outshines us, and our hearts resent it. That is natural to the human nature. The Bible addressed it as a very deep, deep problem. I saw that as a missionary. We began to unteach that, if I can use that language. Let me illustrate it, though, how destructive it can be. In our war for independence, it was not the British. It was envy that almost cost us the war. In the Battle of New York with George Washington, one of his generals who envied him deliberately did not show up when ordered to do so. He simply despised the fact that Washington had been given the command, and he thought he should have. He didn't show up in a timely manner, and they lost in New York. Horatio Gates, the hero of Saratoga, also envied, we know from his letters, George Washington. Yes, he won at Saratoga, particularly because of the actions of Benedict Arnold, who at the time was still loyal. But Horatio Gates despised Washington. He thought he should be the commander-in-chief of the Continental Forces. And he led what became known as Conway's Cabal, or he was implicated, a mutiny that began in the war, or in the Continental Army. It was stopped by better men than he. Benedict Arnold. All of us know Benedict Arnold and his later betrayal in the War for Independence. We didn't realize why he did it. It was envy. He had won at Saratoga for Gates. Gates got all the glory. Benedict Arnold was quite a soldier, quite a strategist in his own right, and very, very courageous. But he got angry. He wanted the glory. He wanted to be touted as the hero throughout the colonies, and it didn't come his way. We can see in his correspondence, we can see in his actions and those that knew him, he was extremely envious. He hated the fact someone else had something better than he, in this case, a better reputation, the praise and the laud and the glory that comes with achievement. He wanted it, they had it, and he betrayed it. That betrayal, that envy mentality almost produced a loss. You find that in the Bible, Christ's very death, he knew that envy, we're told in Mark and Matthew both, that Christ knew he was envied by the other religious leaders because why? Christ was getting the attention. There were crowds following him, and they worked feverishly to try to trap him in his words, to try to confront him. It was envy since they couldn't stop him, they couldn't outsmart him, and they couldn't get at him directly. They finally had to conspire to get him killed, first by betrayal by one who envied him, namely Judas. So you see all throughout the Bible, throughout history, throughout even our history as a people, envy has played a much, much greater role, unfortunately, and often tragically, to the destruction of those that are envied. And the Bible warns us, we have to be very careful of that. The fact is, envy transfers over into the allegations made against those who make a profit, don't they? We hear that the profit motive, anybody that makes a profit is ripping off someone else. In fact, it's very commonly taught in colleges and universities, and unfortunately, and as per your comment earlier about co-opting a Christian ethic, unfortunately, we in the churches are our own worst enemy. How many pulpits teach that when a man or a woman in business makes money, that they're ripping off someone else? The idea being that I made money that took from you. That's not the biblical prescription. That's not a free market prescription. That is, in a free market, it's not a zero-sum game. In other words, I took from you and you don't have. It's you lost two, I gained two. The point here is that in a free market, there is reciprocation. I get value as long as I'm not coercing you, meaning I don't have a gun to your head in some way, like a law. As long as I'm not deceiving you, I'm representing honestly what's in front of you. Here's what I offer for you. You take in the trade something you think is of better value than what you're giving up. I take in the trade something that I believe is of greater value to me than what I'm giving up to you, whomever you may be in this trade. You notice how we both think we're getting the better deal, else we wouldn't have traded. I'll give you an example.
What people don't realize, it's an exchange of equal value. For example, I've had several businesses, and sure, one of the ones we had was a printing business. So I go through my personal work, toil, and supplies, and I exchange that for you, and you are going to give me currency, which I feel is of equal value. And
right,
people don't see that. You're exchanging equal values.
Sure. You know, there's a great example from our own history, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. We were still using what should be called a free market, and I would even add a biblically free market. Now, the 1906 earthquake, 200,000 people that survived were displaced. Their homes were destroyed in that massive tragedy. 75,000 immediately got charity from the surrounding area. However, the other 125,000 people, let's take a look at what happened. In the month that followed, I'm talking about 3.5 to 4 short weeks, the newspaper came back up and began printing again. They had been damaged, but not destroyed. You would expect that in the want ads, people that wanted a home, needed a home, an apartment or something, you'd expect to see pages and pages filled with, I need a home for my family, I'm destitute. You know how many there were? There were six. There were six ads of people that needed a place. That's it. Now, what happened? Reciprocation in a free market. In a free market, what happened is that the other 125,000 people were absorbed into the countryside, you might say. Yes, there was further charity from churches. Much of the charity, however, centered around something for something. You folks can have a place on my farm to stay, And in to reciprocate, they would work for the farmer. Churches found jobs for people all over. The church was very big, in fact, in helping people. 125,000 people were absorbed into the countryside, you might say, for miles around, where people had jobs. They had a place to live. Their families were taken care of. They were working. There was something for something. You know, one of the myths of the socialist mindset, particularly the labor movement, is that there's a scarcity of work. That's not true. In our world, there's plenty of work. There's a lot of work. If you don't believe me, come on over to my house. I got plenty for you to do. However, we have to be careful of the system that distributes, or shall I say, the system that we use to get the information about that work, and that's a pricing system. In a command system, socialism, I call it theologically a hate thy neighbor. I call socialism in all of its forms a hate thy neighbor theology, first and foremost. It does. Socialism, despite its humanitarian emphasis, always ends up cruel to those it proposes to help. Now, the fact of the matter remains that in a socialist mindset, you're going to end up with a mismanaged economy. Think of it this way. As two Soviet scientists pointed out years ago, I'm talking about economic scientists, they said that in the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union before it collapsed and why it collapsed, things are run by committee instead of the pricing free market system. He said, if you live by committee, how in the world can a committee that's responsible for, at that time, 20 million prices or 20 million allocations of goods per day, how can a committee know what you need in the next hour? I don't even know what I need in the next hour. And Friday, I had a little bit of a trauma, a little bit of a physical trauma. I'm fine. Everything's okay. But it certainly changed my day, Friday and into Saturday. The fact of the matter is my needs shifted. Tell me a committee in Washington could know that as they allocate the goods and resources I needed, and I needed right now. The Soviet scientists pointed out that the old Soviet Union had at least five times the potential resources per capita, per person in the Soviet, over that of the United States. And yet they had at least double that amount in wasted resources. They were sitting in committee-funded and founded warehouses, which they didn't know how to distribute. I'll give you an example, then I'll turn it over to John for a moment. But just 2 years ago, how many of you remember that Beijing created kind of a Guinness World Record? How many of you remember that? Communist China set a world record for traffic jam. Its traffic jam extended from its capital all the way to the Mongolian border. The reason for that is the highway system did not develop or evolve as a result of the needs of a free market and transporting goods to market. It evolved from dictates of committees that set it up to especially help diplomats and transport armies. Remember, it's a coercive system. In undoing the largest traffic jam in history, Beijing's committee went on and created an even larger traffic jam. And that one extended longer in lines than the one that extended from the capital to Mongolia. Again, why? It took months to undo, to the ruin of many people sitting in their cars, months to undo those traffic jams. Why? Because it's a collective system. It speaks of kindness, humanitarianism. Hey, we provide these free, whatever it might be, whether it's highways or goods, it doesn't matter. It ends up, as the Bible says, the tender mercies of those that really are evil in heart are cruel. Promises, promises are promises, but performance is reality. And that's the problem we're dealing with when dealing with Washington.
He's making a profit out of me. Remember when I said that when I've done broadcasts with Wayne in the past, it doesn't shut down the phone lines with calls. I have found that people are hearing things they've never heard taught before from a profound point of view, so they're listening. We're happy to interact with our listeners. That means a lot. But I wanted to throw something in very quickly.
Speaking of which, I've got someone also on hold here.
Good.
Okay.
Good. And we want to come back to the envy of Romney when we get back later. That's important. But let's talk with a caller, please.
Okay, area code 770. I do believe this is Dr. C. Robert Jones.
It is indeed, Annie. Great show. Wow, your guests are fantastic. I'm riveted listening to them, honestly. It is a great show. I don't have any comments at this moment. I'm enjoying listening to the two guests you have. Their points are excellent. They're making such great sense. I'm honestly enjoying just listening to the conversation, just listening to what they have to say. But I will chime in when a question presents itself.
All right. Well, Dr. Jones, what I'll do is I'll send you also the link to the Third Rail Radio so that way you can book these gentlemen on your show too.
Great. Look forward to it. All right.
Well, Ann, if I can, when Wayne was talking about the envy mentality, the lights were flashing in my mind, of course, and probably in yours. Yesterday on CNBC, we saw all of the outrage about the idea that Mitt Romney had made $20 million last year. Perfect example of people seeing that as a ripoff. Where can you invest money so as to make $20 million of income or profit? Only in stocks or bonds or real estate development, oil or gas. In other words, he was one of the biggest employers of human capital. And we know that in the case of most of our listeners today and most of my friends in life, they're people who would call themselves workers for someone else. In other words, an employer is a customer of the man who has only his time and his talents and his labor to offer. And we are being stupid enough at the behest of the Obama Marxist campaign and the David Axelrods of this world. And if there were a more poisonous viper in American politics than Axelrod, the primary advisor to the president, I don't want to meet him. But, in other words, suddenly Mitt Romney is an enemy. Now, I'm no big fan of Mitt Romney as a stellar gladiator for freedom. We've had a bad habit for over 20 years of picking the weakest Republican in terms of fervency of belief and making him the candidate. And I'm thinking, of course, of John McCain, a rhino if I ever met one. But the point is that Mitt Romney is not an enemy because he made the money. He is an employer of people, capital, and he has produced goods that people want to buy. I think a point that's always lost is that every business out there is like a voting booth. You see my point, Ann? It's like a voting booth. When you were running that print shop, you were successful because people thought Ann's business is the best for me. It's what you talked about, equal value being exchanged. So this idea of vilifying or demonizing producers, this is pure poison, and it hurts the consumer, it hurts the worker. I hope what I'm saying is quite clear.
Yeah, and what also gets me is that they were criticizing Romney for paying only 13% on his taxes.
Yeah.
But he was paying 13% on his investments. This is money that he's already paid taxes on. He chose then to reinvest that money to see if he can seek additional. So he's not paid 13%. He's probably paid somewhere close to 50 or 75% on taxes on that individual dollar. But no one is gathering that point. They said, oh,
that's right.
Goodness,
oh,
only 13%.
There's one more that is really evil, and that's when the people with money die. That money that's already been taxed.
Oh, Tony, you can get me started on that one, the death
on
tax.
On the estate tax or the death tax, it scoops out the essence. And when we see the impact in the family farm, and family farms in South Carolina are still a lot of the heartbeat of the economy, to have those farms broken up to pay taxes is an evil. And it goes right back into the Bible. We probably won't have time to go into that, but it is an evil. So let us not demonize those who are actually our benefactors.
Yeah, and they're turning around saying the death tax should go down to people, they're saying as low as $250,000 in value. Well, you think about that. You've got a family farm that may be worth, say, for example, you've got 60 acres worth $1.5 million, and it's divided among... You've got five brothers, six sisters, a couple of aunts and uncles, but it's divided among all these individuals. But they look at that family farm as one entity, not at how it gets dispersed among the individuals. So now they're paying the death tax. And how are they able then to divide that farm? They can't. They have to sell it. And that farm now goes out of business. You have less production of whether that's corn, alfalfa, rice, whatever it is. Your production has now gone down, and now the cost of that commodity has now gone up because you have less produce in that area.
And that's absolutely true. And let's make one important distinction for our listeners, because, again, I know enough about Southern Sense. Your people are not beginners. They're thinkers. We're teachers, so we love people who like to learn. There's a difference between an income tax, and the income tax had been ruled illegal in America by the Supreme Court back around the 1900 era. But there's a difference between an income tax and a capital tax. Let us remember that the estate tax and the death tax are like putting a giant sponge into the water. It just soaks it right up. It destroys capital within families, which will produce less income for everyone. And what do we do with the money that the government gets in this capital tax? It invests it with the poorest managers in the world, which are government bureaucrats, as Wayne just pointed. So we take the money that fuels progress and compounds, and we soak it up and essentially throw it away. It is a little known fact that efficient, competitive, free market capitalism lowers prices over time. Prices,
you know, there's
get
an
lower
important...
and lower, and therefore money goes further. No one talks about it. Wayne, I interrupted.
You know, there's an important principle, biblical principle, that I think all of our listeners, whatever their religious inclination, might be aware or should be made aware of. And I've always found that it surprised audiences when I said it. John, you and I have talked about it many times. The Bible addresses the issue of money, now not greed, money, as an issue of blood and money.
Yes.
The Bible speaks in terms of redemption. That was to buy someone out of their debt bondage, for example, as redemption. So redemption was. Understand this about the Bible's protection of wealth from rapacious, those that enact laws toward mischief is the way the Bible speaks of it. As the Bible speaks of it, those who frame mischief with a law is what it's addressing. The Bible speaks in terms of money and wealth as a metaphorically as blood. Let me illustrate. Let's say you get paid by your employer and he pays you in cash. I'll make the illustration simple. For 45 hours of work, you happen to walk down the wrong alley and you get robbed. Now, the person that robbed you of that, of your wallet and all that cash, has not just taken cash, he's taking 45 hours of your life that you cannot get back.
Yes.
Now, you'll probably survive that unless it keeps on happening. Then you'll bleed to death, meaning your blood expended. Now, the Bible speaks in terms of time and blood, an interrelationship, hence redemption. The time, your life's expenditure, has now been robbed. If it keeps on happening, you're going to be in big trouble. Now, what do we have happening? Annie, you mentioned it earlier. The Washington is proposing higher taxes. That goes to what is called the Keynesian economic fix. I won't address that now, but here's what's common sense, actually biblical sense, should tell us. When you tax an already beleaguered entity, you're adding to its expenses, its cost. You're creating greater hemorrhaging. Even though you use a law to do it, what you're doing is the same thing that's being done in the back alley, except that it's constantly a flow of blood.
Yeah.
And what happens is that when you have that happen, there are marginal businesses, meaning those that are just making it, that now that added expense knocks them out, they close their doors, and they lose, and they send their people out into the streets. And on top of it all, they're accused of being greedy because, oh, they weren't going to keep their businesses open. But what you've also done is you've pressed the margin even closer to others that were doing better. They were doing better in the economy, but now they're at the margin. The more you keep adding any expense to a business, you will inflict damage. It doesn't matter what the expense is. It only matters that it is. It doesn't matter if I get a pinprick in my arm but don't stop the flow. I will eventually die, or if I take a bullet in the chest. It matters as far as the time involved, But eventually, if I don't stop the flow of the blood in the one, it'll kill me just as surely as a bullet in the chest.
There's another
the same is
evil.
True with our regulatory system. And
I was
we wonder
just
why
say that.
When we add more cost to the business sector, we disinvest them, and as a result, they have to put people out on the street, unemployed. And then we take the money and we waste it. I shouldn't say always waste it, but very often it's redistributed elsewhere and does not really produce. Now, one last thing. It is impossible in a free market to implode what is called the division of labor. The Bible says that. Sound economy says that. It's impossible to do that unless you have this kind of massive interference like we're getting. And our division of labor, people with different jobs, doing different specialties, contributing their expertise, their wealth, their time, their labor to the market, is imploding. That's impossible in a free market. It doesn't happen like that. It is, however, happening in what I call the hate-mongering socialist economy.
And there's another subtlety here. And again, I think your listeners can handle this one very well. There's not only the problem of taxation, there's the problem of federal government or central government regulation that has the same effect. I'm going to give you a real-life example. Back in the early 1970s, I was doing heavy-duty fundraising for the conservative cause before I became an investment advisor. And I was calling in the chairman of the board of the world's leading manufacturer of a certain area, power shaft couplings and complicated speed reducers, gearing. They were the best. And my friend Louis said to me, John, let me explain to you why so many businesses don't oppose big government. And the point I want to make and put up right up here on the screen for people is that big government and big business often get along well with each other because big government makes things so difficult for the small guy, he can't survive. Louis said to me, he said, John, we had $1 million fix-it order from the EPA on blast furnace emissions. I think this was 1971. He said, we had the money, no problem. He said, our smaller competitors did not have the money. They went out of business. We didn't have to build new plants and equipment. He said, we put on two more shifts of workers, largely their workers, but not always. And he said, we made more money. He said, I hated it. The principle was all wrong, and it's the kind of thing that will kill America. In other words, regulation and taxes disproportionately punish the up-and-coming, and without the up-and-coming, we have no economic progress for America, and the future of American workers is dark indeed, and jobs automatically flow across the pond to Asia. And I had to throw that in because what a memory of a man being honest enough to talk about how big government seemed to be helping him, but it was destroying the country.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay, Doc, go ahead, and I'm going to bring a caller in. Go ahead, Doc.
All right, you know, given the fact that history has taught us that socialism, Marxism, communism simply doesn't work in the long run, at the very least, why do you think so many Americans are embracing President Obama's mantra of class warfare, centralized government, and all of that that goes along with it?
I'll jump in on that, Wayne. You probably would have more to say on it than I, but there's a certain disease of the mind that involves two things, greed and self-interest, and they tend to blind us in the short term, Doc. In the short term, they blind us from longer-term considerations, and we get led around by the nose. So it is some of it is ignorance, some of it is greed. It is certainly selfishness, and there's a difference between the politician and the statesman. The politician panders to the short-term thinking, the self-interest, and the greed of ignorant voters. The statesman is willing to take a hit because he thinks beyond the next election, he's thinking about the well-being of the people. He sees himself as a trustee of his country's future.
Oh, I don't know
what that was.
Okay.
A trustee of the nation's future. That is a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. And do we have a listener ready to chip up on the green?
Well, we have someone from South Carolina here, area code 843, but they've got to turn their speakers down so I can bring them back in. It looks like they were rebooting their system. That's what we heard in the background.
Oh, okay.
So, all right, well, I have one more follow-up question then, if I may. And that is, you know, given that you suggested, and I tend to agree, that envy is as envy is as natural to us as breathing.
Yes.
How do you think that this wealth envy, us against them, rich against poor, is going to play out this coming November with the president and his administration dividing the country primarily based on envy?
I have an answer. I was discussing this with a bright friend just yesterday. If we were card players, we wouldn't win many card games by playing deuces. The Republican Party has become masterful at playing deuces. In other words, when I look back at the election when Bill Clinton became president, it was almost as if the president threw that election. Now, I don't say factually that he did, but it was such a weak performance by George H.W. Bush that you'd think, do you really think you can win the election that way? The Republican Party is not going to be able to win this election only by talking about economics or jobs. But that's where the focus is. Now, we need to be brilliant in our economic commentary. Do not get me wrong. I think by talking about incentive and talking clearly about how people can do better, that we'll get ahead. But there are so many issues the Republican Party is not touching. They're national survival issues. They are protect the border issues. They are the fast and furious issue. I think your listeners know about that, Ann. I know that you've talked about it on Southern Sense, fast and furious. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, allowing guns to walk to Mexican drug lords. There are so many issues that can be laid right at the feet of this almost criminal administration. But we won't touch it. We do not have the heart for combat. We will not clank swords. So I don't think, Doc, that we can limit ourselves just to economics. We have to play this one to win because there are so many people that see with you and me that losing this election can lead us almost into a new dark age, but also the slippery slope into what the Bible calls captivity. And I, John Silk, refer to as dictatorship. I did a talk in 1973 on the topic of the primrose path to tyranny. And if any of our listeners really want to know about it, they can contact us on the Third Rail Radio. But I think we have to broaden just beyond economics. We have to be brilliant when we do touch on it. And we're not very brilliant. I'm very displeased with our economic commentary. That's a long answer.
Well, let me, Doc, let me bring on this other caller because he's been waiting patiently.
Oh, yeah.
And I do believe this happens to be a friend of mine. Is this Judge Murray Silver calling in?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Judge Silver. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I was just listening to this discussion here, and it all sounds very good, but you see what we have in America today is an entitlement society, and Obama has sold that aspect of it very well, and that's where his support is.
Yes.
So you can sit there and talk till you purple in the face, telling them how much hard work and labor and honesty and decency and one man and one wife and everything else. And they look at you and say, it's lovely. See you later. I got to go pick up my food stamps. So I see this thing as entirely different, I think, and I agree with the speaker that Mr. Romney's going down the wrong path when they want to continue and stay on the economic thing. I honestly believe that, and what I see happening is that over the next 45 days, the stock market will be lukewarm, employment will be lukewarm, and come November, this talk about how bad things have been may not be so good. So I think that what you have to do is you've got to talk about Obamacare, which is what I termed Obamacare-less, and I think that you've got to talk about the immigration, the borders, fast and furious, and generally I think that you've got to go back and you've got to start with one of the initial phases, and that is of patriotism.
Yes.
And I believe that if Romney will pick up on that and be aggressive,
yes,
you just can't let this thing slide. And you've got to monitor every single word that he says, and you can't wait 2 days to work up a response. You've
right.
got to be right there and hammer it right then and there. And I just think that as I see this thing unfold, I think Romney is missing these opportunities. This fellow Ryan is a brilliant young fellow. I think he will give a good accounting of himself. But I'll tell you what, Joe Biden is a joke, and that's the way they're going to treat Ryan. They're going to treat him as a joke. It's going to be one clown laughing at the other one. So I see this thing as the only way you're going to win it, and I've been writing it in my blog now for 2 years, and I hope that everybody will understand that this is not racially motivated, but you've got to call a spade a spade. And you've got to get out and hammer the bad things. And my goodness gracious, if you look at them, I must get 1,000 emails a week from people telling me, why don't I talk more about the patriotism, the lack of patriotism, the lack of Christianity, the inability to attend church, and all of these things. This has got to be a part of the basic
yes.
approach of any Republican campaign. So far, I don't see it. And I hope that this convention in Florida will help some. I suspect that he'll get maybe 1 or 2 points jump. But right now, when you watch what's happening, and I tried to watch a little bit yesterday afternoon, and I don't know if all of y'all watched it, but when that woman asked Obama at that press conference, she says, did you approve or do you approve of these attacks on Romney? And she listed 3 or 4 of them, including the fact they'd accused him of being a felon, or might be a felon, or whatever.
Yes.
And Obama didn't answer. Instead of giving her a yes or no answer, or yes, we did, or no, we didn't, he said, well, if you've been listening to me, you know that what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Obama programs. So, you've got a guy that will do anything to win this election. And the only other thing that I want to mention, too, now is, and then I'm going to let y'all go, and that is the inability of the Republicans to deal with how the theft of the election is occurring.
Right.
And I get emails constantly from people telling me that already Acorn, although it's operating by another name, Acorn is operating. They've been funded. They got all the money they need, and they're going to do all of the little things that they did last time around, and nothing will ever happen about it.
Oh.
So I see this as a wall. I don't see that this is friendly anymore. And the gentleman that said, if Obama's reelected, what a dark period this will be in America, I got news for you. It will no longer be America.
Yes.
It will
That's
be
right.
the United Socialist States of America. And I don't think many people realize it. And I'll tell you this, Ann, and I'm going to let you all go. Several months ago when I sat down and had a wonderful breakfast with Newt Gingrich, whom I've known for 45 years, and we discussed some of this, and I told him then, I said, Newt, I said, why don't you call Obama exactly what he is? And he looked at me, and his face flushed, and he said, what? What are you talking about? I said, he's a socialist. I said, he's a thug. I said, he's a gangster. I said, he's a community organizer, for God's sake. I said, why aren't we talking about that? And Newt looked at me, and he shook my hand, and he says, you know what, Murray? You're being a little too harsh. And I said, oh, why? Why am I being too harsh? Well, I don't think you can really call him a socialist yet.
Oh.
And I said, Newt, you haven't been watching what's going on for 2 years. I said, that's where we are. And I said, when you get a brilliant expose written by a Russian news analyst in which he says this country has gone further than the Russian Revolution and the Russian socialist movement, the Marxist socialist movement in Russia, he says, we've gone beyond that. And he says, what impressed him, this Russian, was that nobody noticed, nobody cared, nobody called it what it was.
Oh, when I next come to South Carolina, please arrange for me to take this gentleman out for lunch.
I have a question for the judge, if he's in the mood to take one.
Sure.
Judge, my name is Clarence Jones. I wonder at times if Mitt Romney should become more like or adopt more of the lines of Ronald Reagan. You know, we don't have a Ronald Reagan. He's never coming back. We all know that. But I sometimes wonder if Ronald Reagan were running a lot as well and running against Barack Obama, the race would pretty much be over.
Dr. Jones, you seem to have faded out. We lost Dr. Jones here. So Judge Silver, he was basically asking if Romney should act more like a Ronald Reagan.
Well, I don't like the word act. I think that Romney has to be Romney, and all he should look in the mirror. My God, the guy's handsome, yep. But he's too handsome.
Yep.
He's too slick. He's got that hair greased back, and he's too slick.
Judge Silver, you know I love you dearly, but you know you got a little face envy there, sir. Hey, listen, gentlemen, we're down to our last 5 minutes here. This has absolutely been fun and fascinating.
Well,
Judge Silver, will you be kind enough to give your lovely bride a kiss for me?
I'll do that. She's playing the piano as we speak.
I can hear her.
She gets all upset when she hears me talk.
I heard the piano.
I wanted to pass this along to you and your guest. I was honored. Last month, I was invited 3 times by the University of Texas to address 3 different classes. And we did it by using the wonderful device called Skype, S-K-Y-P-E, in which they could see and hear me and I could see and hear them. And they wanted me to talk for an hour. And I said, no.
You can do that. I know you can go an hour.
I said, I'll talk for 20 minutes, and then I'm going to throw it open to questions. And we did that, and it was so fantastic. The response was incredible to the point that they said, we're going to do this again in September, God willing, but we want to throw it open to 6 classes instead of just 3. So one of the major things that they asked me, if I were young and in college, et cetera, what would I tell those people? And I said, first of all, I'd tell them to have respect for yourself. Have respect for the other person and take responsibility for your actions. And finally, and this got the biggest laugh of the night, I'd turn off the televisions.
Absolutely. Well, listen, and, we're down to our last 2 minutes, so I really got to start closing this off.
And Ken, you allow me to chip up on the green. This is John Silk, and I want to meet the judge in the future. One of the reasons that we are doing Third Rail Radio, this is something that we did 15 years ago. Wayne Sadlack and I know how to mobilize thousands of local Paul Revere's. We have crisis after crisis coming down the road along that primrose path to tyranny. Every one of those is a wake-up point for new people. If our listeners go to the thirdrailradio.com and they look at the segment on town criers, they'll learn how they can be informed when a crisis is brewing in Washington. I agree with the judge that we need to be hitting much harder. We need to win this campaign, and our partisan politicians don't think about winning a campaign. I do. We must awaken new people for the battle ahead, and that's why we were willing to be on Southern Sense. We need to reach, and this is the answer to the judge's lament, his sadness. We're trying to reach people, Ann, who don't vote. They're so demoralized that they don't show up. We're trying to give them a motive, are we not, to show up at the polls if just sleeping Christians who have been sitting this one out for decades start voting, we'll win this election. If people who are demoralized vote in this election when they haven't been, we will win this election. We will buy more time. I hope that makes sense.
We bet. I can say you guys are probably the most educated and smart guests we've had. One of the problems I think we address is we're looking for Obama. We're looking for Romney for the answers. You know what? We need to look within ourselves for the answers, the people, and Jesus Christ. Therein lies the truth. And the bottom line is that you guys have been awesome. Incidentally, your words on George H.W. Bush couldn't have been hit home even more. I mean, he was just nothing but a little patsy in those debates. But anyway, thank you, gentlemen. And I am going to be in touch with both of you about a situation happening in my local that I think we could get some town criers on.
Good. Thank you, Ann, for letting us be there. I think Wayne Sadlack is going to be a guest there again next week. Thank you very much, Ann.
I think you're also being a guest on the 28th again.
Possibly so. I'll have to look at the calendar, and I know that you have Larry Pratt coming from Gun Owners of America, who's part of our stable of experts. That's a great one. He'll make people laugh and cry almost same time.
You guys better hurry because it's not going to be long before Annie's going to be moving up in the world.
Mike,
next
stop
thing
starting
we know,
rumors.
She's going to be on ABC.
Stop starting rumors. Meanwhile, we're going to have Friday. We'll be back again at 2 o'clock, same bat time, same bat station. And our special guest on Friday will be actor Gary Sinise. He'll be talking about the Lieutenant Dan Band and the weekend they have coming over here in South Carolina in September. So it's going to have a lot of good stuff coming up in the future. So please remember to follow us and friend us, and then we will let you know when the new shows are coming up. Every Tuesday
also,
and Friday,
Annie,
2 p.m.
Also Friday show, everyone. Doc Jones joins us in the third seat. So it's going to be Annie, myself, and Doc Jones.
I thank Reverend Seth and John Selk for being our guests. They will be joining us again. And I hope you all enjoyed the show today. And again, like I said, same bat time, same bat station here on Friday with actor Gary Sinise. So have a very happy, healthy week, and good night, and God bless.
Good afternoon, everyone.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don. American.